This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The percentage of homelessness is higher than it's ever been, and it is more visible than it's ever been. Yes, during the Great Depression, we have the Hoovervilles. The sheer numbers are so much greater. The last count of homelessness found over 650,000 people that were unsheltered.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Jim Burling, Vice President of Legal Affairs at the Pacific Legal Foundation and author of the recent book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. We talk in depth with James about that book a little bit later on in today's program. First, we're joined by Dr. Richard Samuelson. He is Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale's Washington, D.C. campus. Dr. Samuelson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's good to be here.
Chatting today about the First Continental Congress, the 250th anniversary. First Continental Congress from September 5th through October 26th of 1774. And I guess let's begin by what led to this, right? Before the First Continental Congress, what kind of legislative bodies existed in the colonies or between the colonies? How was government set up?
Well, you're asking two different questions, right? The only legislative bodies, elected legislative bodies in the Americas before the American Revolution were the ones in the British American colonies, including those, by the way, that did not rebel in the Caribbean, etc. And that set them apart. The colonists all had elected government. They were very familiar with it. They were very used to it. And much higher numbers of adult males voted than did in England, which created a real difference. There was no common legislative body for all of the colonies together. After the Stamp Act was passed, and there was resistance to it, probably James Otis, not certain, suggested there be a Congress of the colonies to meet, and they met in Philadelphia and told Parliament that they ought not to be doing things like pass the Stamp Act, which played some role, but not a major role. Probably the other things, the boycott, played more of a role in Parliament repealing the Stamp Act in early 1766. And then Parliament passed what was known as the Coercive Acts in 1767. There was no Congress, but there were increasing committees of correspondence, so the colonies would, leadership of the colonies would correspond with each other. And then Parliament repealed almost all of the Townshend Acts, except for the tax on tea, left on symbolically in 1770. And in 1773, they modified the Tea Act to make it easier to try to enforce, and the colonies revolted. They refused to allow the tea to enter. The governor of Massachusetts, Governor Hutchinson, whose sons actually owned some of the tea, tried to force the landing of the tea, and the colonists resisted in the form of the Boston Tea Party. The reaction to that was what the Parliament called the Coercive Acts, and the American colonists called the Intolerable Acts. First, they shut down the port of Boston, Boston Port Act, until they paid for the tea. And they also passed the Quartering Act, which meant that they had the right arbitrarily to decide if houses were unoccupied, they could quarter troops. The Bostonians just did that too. They also at the same time passed the Quebec Act, which was not intended to be the same. It was about reorganizing the government of Quebec and also changing the borders to the colonists felt like they were being hemmed in on the West, mm-hmm. and there was a less non-English form of government in Quebec, which was not unreasonable given that they were not English by background, but the colonists saw that as a threat. What they wanted to do was create arbitrary government in all the colonies. So the colonists reacted to these coercive acts, or intolerable acts, by convening a Continental Congress, which met in the start of September of 1774 in Philadelphia.
So explain, if you can, kind of the mechanism to make that happen. How was it called? Was it unanimous among the colonies that this was necessary? How did it all come together?
Well, the colonies were corresponding with each other, and in reaction to the Intolerable Acts, rather than isolating Massachusetts and Boston, as they expected, it backfired. That is, George Washington thought the Tea Party may have been a bit excessive, but then he saw the Intolerable Acts. Oh, that's crazy. If they can do that to them, they can do that to us. Mm-hmm. We have no rights which Parliament feels obliged to accept. Therefore, we have to support some kind of joint action against these Intolerable Acts. And so there was large consensus among the ruling classes of, or the ruling groups, I'll put it that way, of the colonies to have a meeting, which they did in Philadelphia.
Talking to Dr. Richard Samuels at about the 250th anniversary of the First Continental Congress back in 1774. The First Continental Congress was seen as a body of sovereign colonies, then sovereign independent states. How has that formed our current understanding of Congress, perhaps, and has that view changed over time?
Well, it's very interesting. This is the First Congress, which met just briefly for a little less than 2 months and then dissolved. Then we get the Second Congress, which comes later, after Lexington conquered. And that was a meeting of quasi-independent colonies, all seen as connected through the king in a larger British empire. And the larger historical background is essentially Britain became an empire, as the old saying goes, in the absence of mind. These colonies had developed from backwaters with a few thousand people to 2 million people with significant economic status on the coast of mostly 50 miles of the coast of North America. And there had to be some way to organize all this, and it had never really been done. The colonies were kind of quasi-independent, just as in the colonial view, the king had formerly been the king of England and king of Scotland separately till the crowns emerged in 1707. Their view is, since every colony since Georgia has been settled before the Glorious Revolution in 1688, they had gotten their charters directly from the king, not from Parliament. Therefore, their relationship was with the king independently mm-hmm. of the government of Great Britain under Parliament. So they saw themselves as quasi-autonomous in this larger British empire. And that's part of the underlying constitutional issue that led to the Congress. There was no general consensus about what this British empire was constitutionally. John Adams would say, well, the British empire is a term of newspapers, political pamphlets. It doesn't have constitutional meaning. That was part of the issue. So when they get together through Congress, it's quasi-independent, quasi-autonomous. One thing you can say happened, actually, is when we ratified the Constitution in 1787-88, that's when we brought clarity to this situation, when the states formally agreed in the ratifying conventions to have a relationship directly with them and explicitly to delegate certain numbers of powers to the people did in their conventions, not the states, to the federal government. And the Articles of Confederation, which were finally approved in 1781, were of largely autonomous states. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, being in Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation.
All right. You're a scholar of John Adams and Adams' family. Tell us a bit about the major players at this First Continental Congress, and what about the role of John Adams and Adams' family in the First Continental Congress?
Well, Adams and his cousin Sam were there, and they met Charles Thompson, who would be the secretary, known as something called the Sam Adams of Philadelphia, they called him. But the leadership came down, and they were in a somewhat mixed state. They had to be careful because the rest of the colonists weren't sure if the people from Massachusetts, you know, they were crazy Puritans. They had to play the moderates. So when it came to opening a prayer, the Adams says, sure, we'll hear a prayer from Episcopalian. If memory serves, I didn't get a chance to look this up. I believe Sam Adams made a point of going to a Catholic mass to show this was not about religious divisions. This is about us all being on the same page mm-hmm. in our fight against Britain. And so they had to play it cool. And then in the middle of September, the Suffolk Resolve from Massachusetts came down saying we will support, basically declaring support for the rights of Massachusetts against this attack by Parliament. And there was general support for that. But they had to defer to others because if they got too far ahead, as leaders, there may be significant pushback. the other thing that's going on here is the leaders are starting to meet each other and take each other's measure and get to know each other, which is very important for moving through the revolution. And it's also someone like John Adams, who was, you know, a great courtroom lawyer, also trained himself to try to observe people. He noted their quirks, what motivates them. So he has some great comments. And they're all sniffing each other out, like dogs sniffing each other's rear ends to get to know each other. And you had, you know, Benjamin Harrison, the big burly Virginian, and you know, Peyton Randolph, who they were quite impressed with socially, and others. They get to know each other across the colonies. And that's going to be very important moving forward.
We'll return in just a moment and continue our conversation with Dr. Richard Samuelson about the 250th anniversary of the First Continental Congress. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Tanessa Audette, Mayor of Reading. The North State is our home, unique with so much to offer. We are fortunate to have representatives who actually show up, listen to us, and are always ready to fight back, like Congressman Doug LaMalfa. Whether it's a family farmer or small business owner fighting Washington bureaucrats, a wildfire victim struggling to recover and start over, or a local veteran looking to receive the benefits promised and earned, Congressman Doug LaMalfa is always there to take it on and get things done. Let's keep him working for us. This is Tanessa Audette. Thanks for listening.
This is Doug LaMalfa. Serving as your representative isn't about politics. It's about getting results. My mission is to protect our jobs, our water, our Constitution, and our way of life. This is Doug LaMalfa, and I approve this message, paid for by the Doug LaMalfa Committee.
At Greg's Pump and Well Service, we believe integrity is the cornerstone of everything we do. This month, we proudly salute our armed forces and first responders, those who embody true service, dedication, and integrity. When you choose us for your pump and well needs, you're choosing a company that shares those same values. Thank you for your service. Let us serve you with pride. 530-282-5395. Call us at 530-282-5395, license 109-0355.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. 27 years ago, my wife Judy and I started Shasta Gas with the help and under the direction of the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, we believe He is the owner and we are simply the managers. Through the years, we have received many offers from major national corporations to buy Shasta Gas, but our commitment has always been to be and remain locally owned and family operated. Our daughter Karen Wehunt and her husband Jason now manage the daily operations of Shasta Gas and Shasta Tanks, a new business we started a few years ago. We now have the third generation of family members working in the business. Sunshine Stevens, our granddaughter, and her husband Adam, and our grandson Jason. Our commitment and motto are still the same. Our customers are warm friends. To support locally owned family operated business, please call Shasta Gas Propane at 530-365-3793. That's 530-365-3793.
Looking for the freshest top-shelf flower? Look no further than the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake, where they work directly with small, local farmers to bring you the finest flower that fits your price. But that's not all. The Queen of Dragons has the best prices on carts, edibles, concentrates, and pre-rolls. Plus, don't miss happy hour every day from 6 p.m. until close and all day Sundays. Don't just stock up on toilet paper. The Queen of Dragons has great deals, so you can stock up on the best flower for the best prices. So what are you waiting for? Stop by Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-238-5638 for details or delivery. That's 530-238-5638. And don't forget to follow Queen of Dragons on Facebook and X at the Queen Dragons for all the latest deals and updates. Support Queen of Dragons, a local business in the city of Shasta Lake, where you will find the most friendly and knowledgeable staff. Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard. And it's election season, so don't forget to vote.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere Ag and Turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Dr. Richard Samuelson. He is Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus, and discussing the 250th anniversary of the First Continental Congress. Dr. Samuelson, it lasts a little less than 2 months, September, October of 1774. Was there a stated goal at the beginning? Did they know what they were working toward as they started? And how did those discussions and deliberations play out?
Well, they weren't sure. They knew they didn't like the Intolerable Acts. But among the problems they had, one that would plague the Union for the next couple decades, maybe you could argue longer than that, how to vote. Virginians said voting should be proportioned to numbers. And smaller states, as if kind of from the federal convention, said, no, it should be by state delegation, which mm-hmm. is what they ultimately decided on. I mean, Patrick Henry is also there. His comment is, we are in a state of nature. What are these boundaries now that we're questioning the whole British Empire status? He literally says that. You know, what we're in a state of nature. We have no natural relationship with each other. We have to start with us as equal citizens, equal mm-hmm. beings at least. And so they have to negotiate that. And the other big hurdle is what to do with the empire. And Joseph Galloway, who was had long been Benjamin Franklin's deputy, though they were starting to be more and more on the outs, at this point in time, pretty much they were, if I remember correctly, exactly the chronology of their relationship, were not real close anymore. But Galloway, very important in Pennsylvania, he came up with this plan of union, which he'd been working on, essentially saying, well, you know, the Parliament has no rights over us. Nothing they passed since we settled applies. But let's create a union. So there'll be a government for all the colonies that makes laws for us. And then there'll be the general government empire. So there'll be laws that apply only colony by colony and laws apply the empire.
As we get to October and they continue their work, when does the idea of ending the Congress come up? When do they consider the fact that we've done all we can during our meetings here?
What they want to do, the one big cry to have mentioned is what you do in response. And it's they come up with non-importation, which they've done before with regard to the Stamp Act and the Townshend Acts, that is, we're just not going to trade with them. Note, Madison and Jefferson will continue to pursue non-importation effectively in the embargo during Jefferson's presidency. We will not trade with Britain and France because they're mistreating us. Mm-hmm. They keep going back to that tactic. Doesn't work out so well in that case. But what they do, and there's a big deal because the southern colonies are export colonies. They export raw goods. You know, they would, at the Constitutional Convention, they would push for the ban on duties on exports. And they agreed to this, that they would, to non-importation, non-exportation. So they would essentially, they would not purchase goods from Britain.
I want to ask about the Second Continental Congress in a moment, but as we consider the First Continental Congress, how would you describe the lasting legacy of what happened during the Congress, and what should we know and what should we remember about it today?
Well, it's very important in terms of the colonists starting to get together, to work together collectively in union. The key feature is union, right? That these are colonies who did not previously in general have significant relationship with each other. The New England colonies kind of knew each other. Maybe Virginia, Maryland, the Chesapeake colonies worked together. But in general, they did not have common government. They each related independently to the crown. And so them starting to work together collectively, create a union, which would create a government of union, a federal union ultimately, right? That was a huge step because that's the direction they're pointing to. One could say even the problem that rises with the creation of the British Empire, there are two possible solutions. One is what Britain would line up doing. North American colonies are pushed aside. You get what's called the Second British Empire, where they kind of muddle through the relationship with the colonies, and Parliament retains its full sovereignty. And then the federal union is the alternative, where we have a central government, which has certain powers, and the states retain other powers. So they're moving towards that as they create this union. Union has to be both sentimental. There must be a sentiment of union, that we agree we're part of this larger thing, will ultimately be the American citizen. And it has to have a political dimension. And the union doesn't have a formal legal meaning. They all have to sign independently to agree to these documents. But they're starting to move in that direction. And you can see even by the time you get to the articles and then the Constitution, you go from, okay, we accept it's legitimate. Okay, there's a war going on. And we passed the articles by the state governments, but they have been ratified by the people. Mm-hmm. Ratification being something that began in Massachusetts in 1780, the first Constitution ratified by the people. Right. And then we ratify formally the federal Constitution. And you go from 1774, this kind of, or even the Stamp Act Conference, informal union that we agree is kind of necessary. It's off the books. You're kind of a quantum state still working through to the formal ratification of a federal union, which you get in 1787, 88.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Richard Samuelson with us as we talk about the First Continental Congress, and now in relation to the Second Continental Congress, which begins, what, just a year later in 1775. How would you compare, contrast the First Continental Congress to what was a more successful Second Continental Congress?
Well, the First Congress was preliminary. It was John Adams' leave. He says, oh, I won't come back here again. Little did he know. Right? But the point was they were hoping to stave off revolution. The British, you know, the Americans, they liked being British. They had more rights. They were living as well as anyone in the world. I mean, there was very, you know, as a percentage, high literacy, long lifespans, etc., and other, you know, signs of social and political, physical health, psychological health in general. But the British seemed determined to take away their rights. And so they had to start pushing back. And then the British ignored them, and they attacked. They tried to go for the arms supplies at Concord. There was pushback. The war began. And the Second Congress would convene after Lexington, Concord. And troops were massed by the thousands around the British army, which is retreated to Boston. And George Washington shows up at the Second Congress in his uniform. Joseph Ellis says maybe just because it was the thing that fit him best, but, you know, saying, well, probably not. Hint, hint. And after much back and forth of who, how to run this, should it be the local because it's Massachusetts troops, Adams just steps up and nominates Washington. And that's what kind of, Washington leaves room. That kind of settles the issue. And so it's this axis, this alliance between the Massachusetts, Virginia, the old line that the American Revolution is based on temporary alliance between the Adams and the Lee family. That's not really true, but it's an interesting, amusing simplification.
Mm-hmm.
So it was you get after the war started, Adams says, among others, when the sword is drawn, you throw away the scabbard. Look, guys, it's too late. Now, since the war has started, reconciliation is just not going to happen. We have to accept. We got to move forward. Of course, it took them over a year to recognize and accept that in the stages of grief, right?
Mm-hmm.
And bargaining, et cetera. But the Second Congress was about fighting the British at first, nominally just to stop from attacking. But for those who had foresight, they kind of recognized Second Congress met with the program of independence and then managing the results of it. And that's very hard to do. Revolutions do not have a good history of sticking the landing. So the Second Congress begins with that full agenda, really, if you're really thinking it through. And those who were insightful and thoughtful about history and politics were starting to think in that direction. Whereas in the First Congress, they weren't yet thinking that way. They were still hoping, let's stop this before independence becomes necessary.
Hmm. Dr. Richard Samuelson is Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale's Washington, D.C. campus. As we talk today about the 250th anniversary of the First Continental Congress back in 1774. Dr. Samuelson, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Up next, James Burling joins us. His recent book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Auto Body. You've been in an accident with your vehicle. You call your insurance. The first thing they do is tell you where to go to get an estimate and repairs. Well, tell them where to go and come see us at Coachmaster. They're sending you to their discount repair shop to get the cheapest repair possible. This is not in your best interest. You have the right to choose Coachmaster to do your repairs. All we need is your claim number, and we can handle the entire process. At Coachmaster, we don't repair your vehicle for the insurance company. We repair it for you. We use quality parts and products to ensure the highest quality repairs. Your vehicle will be returned to a pre-loss condition. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Coachmaster Collision Repair continues to be the leader in the North State for advanced technology in the collision repair industry. Remember Coachmaster on East Side Road. Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
The property insurance crisis in California is starting to affect the business insurance property also. 200 to 300% rate increases in business property rates or not writing business insurance at all are becoming the norm. At Siskiyou Insurance, we have over 100 years' experience in writing business insurance in the North State. We can help. We live here and care about our community and want to make sure that you keep your business with a local agent that knows our town and supports it every day. And we'll get you the best deal we can. Call Curtis Byron at Siskiyou Insurance Services, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345. Siskiyou Insurance, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. Check out podcast.hillsdale.edu. That is where to find the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. Older episodes of this program, plus all sorts of fantastic Hillsdale College audio. We're joined by Jim Burling. He is Vice President of Legal Affairs at Pacific Legal Foundation, and also author of the recent book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Appreciate taking some time. You begin Nowhere to Live in the introduction, and there's this description of tent cities, and I think we've all seen them by this point in Washington, D.C., or Seattle, San Francisco, Chicago. You mentioned even in your town of Sacramento, there are places like this. We've always had some level of homelessness, of course, across the country, Jim, but is it something different these days?
Yeah, it really is different these days because the quantity of or the percentage of homelessness is higher than it's ever been, and it is more visible than it's ever been. Yes, during the Great Depression, we have the Hoovervilles, the cities on the edge, if you will, but these were smaller. They were internally regulated better. Many of them had their own internal rules. Some had prohibitions against alcohol, for example. But the sheer numbers are so much greater. The last count of homelessness found over 650,000 people that were unsheltered. These are people living in their cars, living in tents, cardboard boxes, under bridges, so on and so forth. And that number is as high as it's ever been. And certainly the visibility is higher than it's ever been. So, yeah, we are in an unprecedented area right now of this country where we have so many people with so few places to live.
You put the number at 650,000. That's the counted number. There are many other uncounted. Clearly, we can probably say it's at least a million, about a third of them unsheltered completely. To the best of our knowledge, Jim, who are these people and how did they get in this situation?
Well, many of them are people that are living on the edge. A number of them have jobs, working class people, but they have just unable to afford rent. You know, some go through short-term social dislocations, a divorce, for example. Many of them are mentally ill, and there's a chapter in my book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis, talking about how we have failed the mentally ill in this country, and a number of them are addicted as well. Once you're out on the streets, it's the temptation and the lure of drugs and more drugs is even greater than it was before. So, but a lot of these people are simply people that are on the edge that it used to be you would spend around a third of your income on housing, whether that's rent or mortgage and the associated costs. More and more people have to spend over half of their income on rent or housing costs, and that leaves little room for medical care, food, shelter. And if they run into a temporary problem, you know, it's the difference between do I go to a doctor or do I pay my rent? And many people are losing their homes as a result. Problem is we don't have enough homes. We're just not building enough homes in this country to make up for the demand. Prices go up as a result, and people are homeless.
Jim Burling with us, his new book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. So, Jim, why doesn't the simple rule of supply and demand take over, take effect, and provide Americans with the housing stock that is needed? What's the disconnect?
The disconnect here is that it is so difficult from a legal standpoint to build the homes that people want to buy. It used to be, a century ago, you had some land, and you could do with that land what you wanted so long as you didn't harm your neighbors. You could farm it. You could cut trees on it. Or you could build homes on that property. But today, with our restrictive zoning rules, with our environmental regulations, and with so many other rules and regulations that are placed on the building industry, it's very, very difficult to find places to build. And if you do find those places to build, it's really hard to turn a profit from the sort of starter homes that people used to live in. Look, my first home back in the 70s was 900 square feet, two bedroom, one bath. People don't build those homes anymore. Legally, they cannot build those homes anymore. Same goes for duplexes, triplexes, quads. If you're lucky enough to find a place where you can build and you meet all the zoning requirements, then you're going to be sued. You're going to be sued by the Not in My Backyard or NIMBY types. You're going to be sued by the environmental community. You're going to be sued. And in California, in my book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis, I talk about developers that have been trying to build subdivisions for over 20 years. As soon as they get one set of permits, they get sued. As soon as that lawsuit is over, somebody else comes in behind and sues them again and again and again. And this is the sort of nonsense we have. So people who might have otherwise put their capital into building homes are now going to look anything else but building homes.
In the book, there are a number of different places and chapters on some of the attacks on private property rights, as you describe it, zoning in some places, eminent domain in other places, environmental regulations we've heard a lot about over the past decades. How are environmental regulations slowing, in some cases, stopping the ability to enhance the housing stock in the country?
Well, first of all, you have a lot of areas that have simply been taken off limits for building, whether that be for wetland protection, whether it's for habitat conservation plans, endangered species protection, viewshed corridors, agricultural preservation zones, open space areas. All these things combined together have taken tens of millions of acres of land pretty much off the table for development. In addition to that, if you are able to find a place you can build, you have to deal. If you need any kind of federal permitting, you have to deal with the National Environmental Policy Act. You have to deal with the Endangered Species Act. And all these statutes, all of them give an entree point for somebody to sue to stop you. They'll say that the environmental impact statement was inadequate. They'll tell you that your habitat conservation plan is inadequate. They'll tell you that you haven't adequately studied enough. In California, we have the California Environmental Quality Act, and it requires people to study over 100 different aspects in order to get a permit under the California law. And as and you look at these EISs, I talked in my book, Nowhere to Live, of the environmental impact reports that are over 6 feet tall, mm-hmm. plus addendums. And so it's incredibly expensive to go through the environmental process, and it has really slowed building down. It used to be you could build a subdivision of the homes in 6 months and be done with it. Now you're lucky if you get through the process, the environmental process, in 6 years.
Talking with Jim Burling, he is Vice President of Legal Affairs at Pacific Legal Foundation. His book is Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. Back in the 1950s, we had this effort at urban renewal, Jim, and what it left us with in many places was disaster. In Chicago, the Robert Taylor Homes, Cabrini Green Housing Complex, the eyesore, and the problems in St. Louis, the Pruitt-Igoe Homes. How do we avoid something like that as we call for more housing and sometimes a denser housing to be built in urban areas?
So denser housing is one thing. These massive government projects are something completely different. Denser housing built by the private sector and run and managed by the private sector, there's an incentive to do things right. But a lot of these public housing projects had problems from the start. First of all, they went in and destroyed oftentimes vibrant communities through eminent domain and redevelopment.
Mm-hmm.
And these vibrant communities were often minority communities, working class neighborhoods that got destroyed. There was a black intellectual named James Baldwin who went around the country calling this the Negro Exclusion or Negro Removal Project, because it took people of color out of these neighborhoods, built these huge projects where poor people were supposed to be warehoused. But government did a terrible job of planning these projects, did a terrible job of building them, a worse job of maintaining them, and then things went downhill so fast. And I talk about this in my book, and I give examples where the people living in these communities of these warehousing central city public projects really were just victims of a terrible set of circumstances. And the only thing government did well was tearing these things down and blowing them up. So public housing projects are not really a good idea because government is not very good at building, maintaining, and creating housing. But if you call for more density so private developers can build it and they're responsible, it's their money on the line, then I think we can see better results.
More on this topic next. James Burling is with us. His book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Whether it's a harvest theme or Halloween, there's plenty of decorations to choose from at Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson. They feature a wide variety of costumes and costume jewelry, along with a lot of fall decor, pumpkins, garland, wreaths, and more. Mix and match antique, shabby chic, and farmhouse furniture. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 6, Sunday noon to 5, and Monday 10 to 6. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Hi, this is Linda Fott. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first first Thursday right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy.
We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right, even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up, fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We've been talking with James S. Burling. He is Vice President of Legal Affairs at the Pacific Legal Foundation. His recent book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. James, those housing projects have been destroyed. The idea, a theme of destruction, I think, comes up often in the book, whether it is Cabrini Green or a family's beach house through eminent domain, or the system of patient labor supported mental health care that you discuss. Do you feel that to an extent the outlook of the American people has changed from one of construction to destruction, from building something up to tearing something down?
Yeah, I think that we have sort of lost our way if we think that we can really build our way out of problems. It used to be we could. In my book, Nowhere to Live, I talk about the tenements in the slums of the 19th century in New York City. And these were horrific places. They were no plumbing. They had no air. And by no air, I don't mean no air conditioning. I mean there were no ventilation, no windows to the outside world, just the hallway, central hallway. These places eventually were replaced by building much better places in New York City. And we built our way out of the immigrant crisis of the 19th century, where we had lots and lots of immigrants coming into this country with not much housing for them, and we built our way out of that. And I think we can do that again. I mean, ultimately, my book is one about optimism. If we can recognize the interests of private property rights, recognize the forces that the market forces that can create housing, and if we allow ourselves to unleash the market forces to build housing near where people want to live, I think we can build our way out of this problem. We do not need more government program on top of government program, because as history has shown, those are generally failures on top of failures.
Jim Burling with us. His book, Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. The subject of rent control has become a topic in this presidential election, beginning with President Biden introducing it, and Vice President Kamala Harris also endorsing a similar policy. You have an entire chapter, Rent Control Makes Housing Worse and More Expensive. Why isn't it the answer? How does it do those two things?
You know, I begin my book with a couple of quotes. One was from S.R. Lindbeck, an economist, who says that the best way to destroy a city other than bombing in a war is through rent control. And I follow that a quote from the foreign minister of Vietnam, who said, you know, the Americans couldn't destroy Hanoi during the war with bombing, but we almost destroyed it by keeping rents too low. The problem with rent control is that it may help a few people who are lucky enough to be having a rent-controlled apartment or home, but for the vast majority of people, what rent control does is create a disincentive for building new homes. Developers have told me simply the first thing they'll look at when they're trying to decide whether to build an apartment building is this jurisdiction rent controlled, or is there a possibility they'll have rent control in the future? And if the answer to either of those questions is yes, they will look elsewhere. What this means is it's a constraint on supply in communities that are subject to rent control. When there is a constraint on supply, there's a shortage. the law of supply and demand requires that the prices go up. So you may have rent-controlled units with lower prices, but the price of housing overall will go up because of the constraints on building new supply. And indeed, rent control doesn't really help the people that it's supposed to help. Rent control is supposed to help working class people, poorer people, minority populations. But we did a study, Pacific Legal Foundation did a study a number of years ago comparing rent control jurisdictions in California with neighboring jurisdictions without rent control. And we compared the demographics of the people living in those communities. And without exception, people living in the rent-controlled communities, those that are supposed to be poor and economically dispossessed, turned out to be whiter, richer, better educated, and better employed than the people in the non-rent-controlled communities. Why? The answer is because people who are able to have stability in their lives, who are able to keep a job and keep the same place for a longer period of time, tend to be whiter, richer, better educated, and have more income, and they're able to take advantage of rent control, whereas the poorer people, minority populations, working class people, are much less able to take care of rent control. So in study after study, rent control doesn't help the people that it's supposed to help the most, and all it does is raise the prices of housing, and eventually it causes landlords who cannot get a recoup on their investment to abandon properties and move out.
What about property taxes, Jim? Is there a need to reform the way we levy those taxes? Certainly, there are particular states in which property taxes are a much bigger deal. I've lived in Illinois. That's a huge problem there when it comes to housing affordability. Is there some sort of a reform needed with property taxes to help in this effort?
Yeah, so we have this vicious circle. We have a shortage of building because it's so difficult to build, causing prices to rise. And in many states, when prices rise through no fault or effort of the homeowner, their taxes go up. And if you have property that somebody might have bought back in the 80s for $250,000, and that property is now worth $1 million, their taxes, if it was a 1% mill rate, have gone up from $2,500 a year up to $10,000 a year, or equivalent. So all across the country, well, that is not really affordable by a lot of people, and a lot of people, especially elderly on fixed incomes, are finding that they can't pay their taxes anymore. They'll lose the property through foreclosure, and their properties will be auctioned off, and sometimes they're given only a fraction of what the property's worth. Some governments have attempted to keep the entirety of the property. I talk about in my book, Nowhere to Live, about a 93-year-old widow that we represented in Hennepin County, Minnesota. She had a condo that was worth, you know, $80,000, $90,000. The crime was so high that she had to move out and move into a senior housing project that her children wanted her to live in. When she did that, she couldn't afford both the rent for that and her property taxes. She fell behind in her property taxes by $2,300. Hmm. The county added fines and fees and interest. So within a couple of years, she owed $15,000. The county sold her condominium. They sold it for $40,000. And the difference between the $15,000 she owed and the $40,000 they got in an auction was $25,000. And the county kept every penny of that. She was left with nothing, even though their property was worth far more than what they got for auction and far more than what she owed, starting with the $2,300 and up to the $15,000. And we had to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, Pacific Legal Foundation, that is, went to the Supreme Court to represent her, and we did win that property back for her. But her plight exemplifies what happens to so many people who are elderly on fixed incomes that they can't afford the property taxes, and as a result, they lose their homes.
Final question for Jim Burling. His book is Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. So what's the way out, Jim? How do we begin to address and change this? I know property rights is one of the main ways that might be a solution.
I think so, because what we don't need is more government programs on top of more government programs. I mean, we talk about government shoveling money into a sector of the economy. What that does is raise prices. What we need to do is allow people to build where people want to live. We need to look carefully at our own, and look in the mirror and ask ourselves in our own community, are we allowing enough building so the people that work in this community can actually live here? Are we allowing enough building so our children, when they move out of our homes, can afford to live here at some point? And the answer all too often is no. So we have to reform zoning laws to allow more to be built within our communities. We also have to look at the environmental rules and regulations. Everybody wants a good, clean, safe, and healthy environment, but at the same time, we want places we can live in because the environment of living in a tent on the street is absolutely horrendous. So what we must do is look at our environmental laws and say, is it really necessary to take this area off limits to building? Should we allow some home building here? We also have to consider whether or not we should allow this sort of litigation to slow down projects that take years and years and years instead of months and months. So we can look at a lot of things, but the bottom line is we have to restore the property rights of landowners so they have the right to build homes near where people want to live, restore their rights to build, and I think we can find our way out of this crisis.
Jim Burling is Vice President of Legal Affairs at Pacific Legal Foundation, and his book is Nowhere to Live, The Hidden Story of America's Housing Crisis. Jim, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It has been a pleasure to talk with you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Richard Samuelson from Hillsdale in D.C. and James Burling, author of Nowhere to Live. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
At Cornerstone Community Bank, you're more than just a customer. You're our friends, neighbors, the local businesses where we shop, and the restaurants where we dine. Your success strengthens our community. Come meet our amazing teams in Reading, Red Bluff, and our newest location in Anderson, and find out why we are more than banking. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC and equal housing lender.
Join us as we celebrate a milestone in American history, the 249th birthday of the United States Marine Corps. Mark your calendars for November 10th at the Wind River Event Center, where everyone is invited to honor the Marines in style. The celebration kicks off with a march to colors featuring the Jefferson pipes and drums as we pay tribute to our oldest and youngest Marines. This unforgettable evening includes a delicious dinner, birthday cake, and dancing. Tickets are just $45, and they're going fast, so secure yours. Visit ShastaMarines.com. That's ShastaMarines.com. Don't miss out on this special event. Tickets are just $45, and they're going fast, so secure yours. Visit ShastaMarines.com. Again, that's ShastaMarines.com. Don't miss out on this special event. We can't wait to celebrate with you on November 10th at the Wind River Event Center. See you there.
KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month starting at 8 a.m. for the Gorman Law Hour featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
The
this is Carl Bott. Join Linda and me Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. We're going to discuss what's happening in our city, county, state, and nation. Join in. Miss a day, miss a lot. Free Fire Radio, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.